but he can talk like a theorist, which in science is a good thing. He started a talk with the Heidelberg Moscow, famous Heidelberg Moscow fellow Benedict, but he left before the Benedict was discovered. And then did a brief sojourn through accelerator based physics before returning to your love, which is now a member of Shell and is a spokesperson for the Cobra experiment. So today we'll be talking about the X-Files of Harvard physics.
Okay, thanks, Cliff, for the introduction, and it's a pleasure to be here and give a talk. I'm aware of the fact that I'm an experimentalist and you are all theorists, and so don't worry, I don't bother you with too much experimental details. Just give you a flair about how tough it is to actually measure neutrinos and what we know about those particles. There are this kind of three kinds of ingredients you use. This is a guy you maybe know. His name is Wolfgang Pauli, who invented the neutrino. This is a kind of phenomenon which is giving us currently the most information about neutrinos, which is neutrino oscillations, some kind of a periodic conversion of one neutrino flavor into another and back. And this is a kind of one of the major key players in the whole field, and the shining swimming pool underground in Japan called Super Kamiokami or Super K. And I'll flash to that in a second. Well, another title would be this one, Mission Impossible, how to explain everything about neutrino physics in 50 minutes. I think it's a feeling pretty much like this person. This is impossible, so I have to focus on a few items a little bit more in detail, and the rest I only basically mention. If you have questions, come back to me later on. So while sitting in my office thinking about talk and what to tell, I have to make some introduction, and this is not John Ellis, by any way. Some introductory remarks and a few historic remarks. So as one of the examples, as Cliff said, I will talk a little bit about the solar neutrino problem and the role especially of SNOW, a supra-neutrino observatory here in Ontario. And then I'll talk about another process, double beta decay, and my maybe focus slightly only on my experiment, and then give you an outlook and a summary. As I said, why are we talking about neutrinos? So if you look back in the history about a century ago, when people discovered alpha, beta, and gamma decays of nuclei, they realized that alphas emitted helium particles are monoenergetic in the nucleus, and gamma rays emitted in the nucleus are monoenergetic. But why are electrons not monoenergetic? They show a continuous kind of energy spectrum. And the question was, what's going on here? Why are electrons showing a continuous energy spectrum? And the people were rather frustrated or depressed. And then even people like Niels Bohr were thinking about at the present stage of atomic theory, you have no argument that the energy principle in case of beta ray disintegration is upholding, which means they were willing to slaughter the energy conservation law. And if you are willing to slaughter energy conservation, which is the holy grail of physics, then you really don't believe in anything anymore. And so there were a lot of good people involved in this kind of discussion. And the solution to this problem was, as I said, given by a guy called Wolfgang Pauli. You all know from Pauli principle and you know, hundreds of other things. And he wrote a famous letter on December 4th, 1930, to the what you would call nowadays the Annual Physical Society meeting of Germany. And he said, dear radioactive ladies and gentlemen, can we talk a little bit about beta decay? I have hit upon a desperate remedy, namely the possibility that there could exist in the nuclei electrical neutron particles that I wish to call neutrons, because at that time the real neutron was discovered, and Fermi renamed this neutron to neutrino a few years later. So he was thinking about this kind of new particle existing in the nucleus, and then you could actually understand continuous beta decay spectrum by the assumption that in beta decay, a neutron is emitted in addition to the electron, such that the sum of the energy of both are constant. It's a typical argument. The electron and this neutrino or neutron share the energy. Sometimes the electron gets more, the neutrino gets less, sometimes vice versa. So, but at the end of the day, they both share the kind of same energy, and this would explain the thing. And he said he made two more comments in this letter. One is he did something desperate and terrible. He has proposed a particle which will never be detected. And the second thing is, at the end of the letter, he writes, unfortunately, I can't be part of the meeting because I have to be at a party in Zurich. You shouldn't do that nowadays when you have a major discovery. So as you can see, the 4th December 30, so recently we basically celebrated 75 years birthday of the neutrino, so I forced one of my postdocs to make a cake to celebrate that in our group. Anyway, we have another celebration, as you can see here, the discovery actually of neutrinos in 56, so we're celebrating 50 years of neutrino discovery because it took another 25 years to find it. In a reaction which is shown here, the so-called inverse Wiedler decay reaction, having an anti-electron neutrino which is coming from nuclear power plants, which are the strongest terrestrial sources of electron antineutrinos captured on a proton, giving you a positron and a neutron. This is a nice experimental feature you can look for. And it was people like Fred Hines who got the Nobel Prize for that, like Cowan and his group in the so-called Project Poltergeist. And the detector they use is shown here. It has a German name. Herr Auge means Mr. I. You can even see the German name still written on here. So this was a discovery 50 years ago. And the current knowledge, let's say, before 10 years ago was pretty much the same. There were two more things. We have now this famous of nice fundamental standard model of particle physics. We know the six quarks. We know the three leptons, the electrons, muons, and tau. And what lab data the Blasi Minus Collider at CERN told us by looking at the decay bits of the set zero boson, the gauge boson of the electric interaction, that the width of this set boson depends on the number of neutrino flavors, 2, 3, 4, green, red, and blue. And you see the data points are well described by assuming that there are three light neutrinos. And these are exactly those guys here. So the electron neutrinos comes with an electron, the muon neutrino comes with a muon, and the tau neutrino comes with a tau lepton. That we know. People, 5,000 people and more are hunting for the Higgs boson. I won't mention that here. And another important quantity which went into the kind of standard model creation at the beginning was that this was well known from Wiedler decay studies as well in the 50s. But if the neutrinos have a mass, it must be less or should be less than 10 keV. Well, the lightest particle known at that time was the electron is 511 keV, which is already 50 times larger. So people were just assuming for a second that neutrinos within the standard model are massless particles. And massless particles obviously have a rather limited number of features to investigate. So in the standard model, people claim neutrinos are massless, and if you discover a non-vanishing neutrino mass, then you actually can people talk about physics beyond standard model. Well, some people say, well, you can do neutrino masses in the standard model. You don't change the gauge structure, so that's fine. But other people say, well, if you have to add something new to the current standard model to make neutrino masses, then it's physics beyond the standard model. That's kind of really minor discussion. So the basic question is, do neutrinos have a non-vanishing rest mass or not? And this is quite one of the three important questions we have, because neutrinos actually affect a lot of fields in physics, from cosmology over via astrophysics and nuclear physics down to particle physics. And the numbers are basically solved by the set widths. The neutrino mass we are exploring, and I give you an example in form of solar neutrinos. And there's another question which is related to the type of neutrino, namely, is a neutrino its own antiparticle or not? We know from an electron and from the quarks, we can tell which is a particle, which is an antiparticle by looking at the charge. And both particles coming in the left and the right-handed state. For the neutrino, it's not so obvious because it has no charge. In principle, it could be a two-component object, and that's being its own antiparticle, and then we would call it actually a Majorana neutrino in contrast to Dirac particles, which are like the Dirac neutrino, which would be the same like an electron or a quark or something like that. This is double Wiedler decay, which I'll show you later, is generally considered to be the gold-plated channel to actually explore this question. Now let's go to neutrino oscillation for a second, because as I said, all the evidence we have that neutrinos in detail, the non-vanishing rest mass is coming from these observations. The idea is it's not invented new for the leptons to explain something people like to explain. It's well known from the quark sector in a way that the mass eigenstates can be different from the actual flavor eigenstates. And this is shown here. Assume you have an eigen system of flavor, eigensatz nu e, nu mu, nu tau, and a system of mass eigensatz nu 1, nu 2, nu 3. And then they are linked, like in quantum mechanics, like with a unitary matrix. But this is shown basically here. You have a nu 1, nu 2, nu 3, and x, y, z system. And you have nu e, nu mu, nu tau, which is x prime, y prime, z prime, so to say. And they are tilted with respect to each other by this kind of angles. And in the three flavor scenario, you actually get a complex phase as well, which isn't shown in this plot because you can't do it. In the easiest case, if you have only two flavor mixing, and most of the stuff I tell you is just two flavor mixing, assuming that there are only two neutrinos mixing, for example, nu e and nu mu, then this kind of unitary matrix is a simple rotation matrix. And this angle theta is in the quark sector, is known as Capivo angle if you talk about D and S quarks, for example. So this would be the leptonic analogon to the Capivo angle. And the 3×3 matrix, because we know we have three flavors, would be just the corresponding CKM matrix or Capivo Kobayashi Maskawa matrix, how we call it in the quark sector. And you have three mixing angles, theta 1, 2, theta 1, 3, theta 2, 3. And we have this kind of complex phase, which could be a source for CP violation in the same spirit, like this phase is a source for CP violation in the quark sector. So this is completely analogous. It's nothing which is newly invented for just to explain neutrino physics. Just the stuff, the formalism developed is extended to electrons. And then you can do your quantum mechanics, basically the oscillation probability, for example. What is the probability if you start with a certain neutrino which you produce at a kind of a source, let's say mu e? What is the probability to find this neutrino at a certain distance or at a certain time later, at a certain distance from your source in a different flavor state, let's say mu mu? And this is kind of schematically shown here. For example, you do the quantum mechanics, you just use the absolute values, the absolute amplitude squared, and then you come up with this equation, which I show you in a second. So this is a probability, and this is, for example, the source of neutrinos, and this is the distance where you place your detector. So if you start with, for example, a muon neutrino beam, if this effect occurs at a certain distance from this, we have 100% muon neutrinos, antineutrinos here. However, at a certain distance, you have a reduction of muon neutrinos down to 70%. But on the other hand, your beam is now consisting out of 30% of electron antineutrinos. And if you go further away, the beam comes back to full 100% muon antineutrinos. It vanishes again, and so on and so on. However, this is a very simplistic picture. You can do it in wave packet treatment. You can include some kind of momentum and energy uncertainties, and then you can do still the full quantum mechanical calculation. And the net result is pretty much identical. And as you see, the kind of Capivo angle, or this mixing angle, theta, is determining the oscillation amplitude. So the theta is maximal, which means 45 degrees. The original nu mu beam completely vanishes at some point, and you have a pure nu e bar beam, and so on. So this theta is telling you the oscillation amplitude. And the wavelength of the oscillation from here to here, for example, is basically determined by a quantity which is called 1 over delta m square. And this delta m square is the difference of two squared numbers. So it's the mass eigenvalue of m2 squared minus the mass eigenvalue of m1 squared. But the first thing to notice is if both masses are zero, you don't have oscillations. So that's why this is important. If you observe that, you know that at least one of those two states have to be non-zero. On the other hand, you don't know, it's not an absolute mass measurement. You only measure the difference of two numbers. So this could be anywhere, you only know the difference. So we have the basic two unknowns, sine squared 2 theta, the amplitude, and delta m squared. L is the distance of the detector from the source, and E is the energy of the neutrino. So these are the two unknowns, and they're normally plotted against each other in a double logarithmic plot. I show you some in a second. But keep in mind, this is not an absolute neutrino mass measurement. I should also mention, to see this kind of, if nature has chosen some specific value of delta m squared, which the sensitivity where you actually observe this effect depends on E over L. So that's the reason why, for example, solar neutrinos, which have an average energy, let's say, of about 10 MeV and a distance of 150 million kilometers, can't be explored by high energy accelerators when the energy is 10 GeV and the L is maybe a kilometer, because if you double in the number, you see that you request really two completely different delta M squares. So what other neutrino sources we can fiddle around with? As I said, like the discovery nuclear power plants are a pure source of new EBAR beams. You can use high energy accelerators, so you smash a proton onto some kind of a target. You get secondary particles, dominantly pions and kaons. And as you probably know, the charged pions decay to a muon and a muon neutrino, and the kaons decay as well in muon neutrinos, but also in electron neutrinos, so you have a mixture here. Then there's a new, rather new topic, which was first discovered last year. People call it geoneutrinos nowadays. The Earth's crust, of course, has a lot of uranium and thorium, which have a lot of isotopes, which are unstable, and they contribute to the heat content of the Earth. And people have discovered this this decays last year. And because it's always involved with beta decay, and as you have seen from the discovery of beta decay, that is again antineutrinos involved. The atmosphere acts pretty much like an accelerator. High energy cosmic rays from the universe are hitting the oxygen and nitrogen in the atmosphere, and you have the same kind of reactions like in a high energy accelerator. The sun is a pure source of new E's, which will come to that in a second in more detail. Supernova, stellar explosion of high mass stars in their late stage of evolution are really bombs of neutrinos, those of you old enough. Remember supernova 87A about 20 years ago when they were first detected, neutrinos from this event, and the Big Bang, of course. So let's talk about solar neutrino and the fundamental meaning. So this, as I said, these are the kind of source, astrophysical sources. If you do neutrino astrophysics, supernova is the sun, the Big Bang is producing, if you believe the standard Big Bang model, in addition to this kind of 2.7 Kelvin CMB background, you should have a 1.96 Kelvin relic neutrino background, which hasn't been observed yet. And we know high energy, ultra high energy cosmic rays, very high energetic particles produced somewhere in the universe, also observed in TeV gamma rays, so there will be very likely very high energy neutrinos as well, and I'm sure Francis Hall recently spoke about the observation of that. The real problem is neutrinos is shown here. They don't interact, especially if they have low energy, meaning the cross section is so small that you have to use a large amount of material to stop one of them at least per day. And you can't do those experiments on the surface. You have to go down in mines and tunnels because there are so many competing background reactions that you will be completely swamped your signal. Meaning it's basically neutrino physics like looking for a needle in a haystack. But if you keep the picture, the haystack has the size of the Earth. So why are solar neutrinos important? Well, the fundamental question is how does the sun produce its energy, which we all believe is, of course, hydrogen fusion to helium. But we people should at least check that this is really true. And so the basic sun reaction is four protons merge into a helium-4, emitting two neutrinos, electron neutrinos, and release the energy we can see. The understanding for this kind of process, especially the modeling of the sun, is of course crucial for all stellar evolution theory and stellar astrophysics. I mean, if you model the sun and you can't reproduce the sun and the solar neutrino flux, I have personally no confidence in simulation of more complex stars if people already fail to model the sun appropriately. As I said, it's a unique view in the interior of the sun because the energy which is normally emitted on the surface of the sun is produced somewhere 10,000 years ago. As I said, neutrinos don't care too much. They just leave the sun and will be at the Earth 8 minutes later. So at the moment, all the neutrino detectors don't see any neutrinos from the sun anymore. You know, either the detectors are broken or the sun stopped energy production. And there are two cycles how the sun can do this helium fusion. PP cycle and the so-called carbon nitrogen oxygen cycle or beta light Zecker cycle. I will only tell you about the PP. And from the neutrino physics point of view, it's a unique source. We have a flip only electron neutrinos, and the source is 150 million kilometers away from our detector. But here, what this kind of sum reaction I showed you is a rather, it's a simple one. However, as you can see on this kind of chains here, the actual stuff is more complex. I only want to mention two things. First one is the bulk of the neutrinos is coming from the fundamental first two merging of two protons to deuteron, emitting the so-called PP neutrinos, because there are two protons of PP. And these ones are directly linked to the solar luminosity. So if you reduce that flux, you basically make the sun brighter and darker. Now this is some kind of a number which doesn't contain too much model dependence. And I want to mention this guy over here. As you can see, here's everything goes down to here, then the chain splits into three, and this splits again in two. And here you see this kind of neutrino as well from so-called boron 8 beta decay. I mentioned that one because these are the highest energy ones we can see. And of course, as you can imagine, it has maybe some model dependent on actually how much it's contributing. Anyhow, it's the back of an envelope calculation. If you look at the solar constant, you can measure on the Earth. You can determine how much energy the sun is releasing per second. And if you know how much energy you get when you merge four protons, you can determine how many neutrinos. You can determine how many protons you have to merge to produce the energy of the sun, and then you know your solar neutrino flux. And the number comes out is we should have on Earth a flux of about 1060 billion neutrinos every centimeter squared per second. So while we are sitting here, we are all flushed by about 100 billion neutrinos every second. I actually gave this once this number in a public talk, and 2 days later I got an email from a lady. She had two bad nights because she was really, really much concerned that every night while she's sleeping, she's bombed and penetrated by some kind of particles. She had a bad time. Anyhow, this is a kind of, if you do the detailed calculation, this is a kind of solar neutrino spectrum. These are this famous PP neutrino. It's a logarithmic scale in energy and in flux. And you see this is the overwhelming flux. It's very high. These are the 60 billions, basically. And unfortunately, it's low energy. So you only see they have a maximum energy of 420 keV. And they can only be detected by those so-called radio chemical detectors, like the famous Homestake experiment of Ray Davis, which actually can't see the PP, but the gallium experiments, which are using like Galax, GNO, and SAGE, which have a threshold from here onwards. The other type of experiments is SNOW and SuperK, this water detector in Japan I showed you on the first slide, and SNOW, which have a threshold of around here, but though, as you can see, they only are sensitive to this kind of region here. The major difference between both is that SNOW is a real-time, what we call a real-time detector. It is, you, for each event, you can write down an energy and a time when you have observed it. So you actually can measure the spectral shape. But the other ones are so-called radiochemical detectors. You put a huge amount of material, let's say 100 tons in a mountain, and you maybe capture one neutrino of one of the gallium atoms a day. And this atom converts into the neighbor, germanium-71. And a germanium atom, and this is radioactive and decays back some days or weeks later. And when you have something like 2 weeks of just putting the stuff there, you have collected something like 14 atoms of germanium. You try to remove them and put them in a counter, and then you wait for the radioactive decays. And for each decay, you see, well, in the last few weeks, I must have captured a solar neutrino because there is no germanium in the tank before. So the gallium can only be converted into germanium if it has captured a solar neutrino. And all neutrinos above this threshold can do that, but you have no idea anymore about the energy of the neutrino and when precisely did it happen. So this is a kind of solar neutrino history. Don't go to the details. You see the theory is higher than the results all the time by 30 to 50%. And this is a famous decade, 30 year long standing solar neutrino problem. So obviously the first question was, who is responsible? Is it the sun? Is the sun producing less neutrinos than we expect, or the neutrino has some kind of funny properties? We don't know. Well, the major, there are a bunch of things which people invented. The major idea for the sun was to reduce the core temperature. For example, the boron 8 flux, and the one I showed you, depend on the 18th power of the core temperature of the sun. And whatever you do, you on average need something like a 5% change in temperature. And the astrophysicists always said, well, this is too much. We can't change the central temperature by 5 degrees and nothing would fit. The other problem is neutrinos. You could do this oscillation. I explained you either in vacuum on the way from the sun to the Earth, or you do already the conversion inside the sun, or neutrinos could have a magnetic moment. They could decay on their way. But each of those properties require a neutrino mass. So let's talk about this oscillation, because it turned out that this is the right solution. So if you have the vacuum oscillations, if you believe that the neutrinos are somehow starting as electron neutrinos, converted to a muon neutrino or a tau neutrino on the way to the Earth, and all the detectors I have shown you are applying to muon neutrinos and tau neutrinos. So then you, if this is a reason, the delta M square we are talking about is about an MeV for a solar neutrino. The distance is about 10 to the 11. So we have a very fine splitting between the neutrino masses of about 10 to the minus 11 eV square. However, in the 80s, three clever people in the chaos universe Wolkenstein came up with a kind of a matter oscillation scenario. In a way, you can understand the following. If you take electroweak theory, you can scatter neutrinos of all flavors by the exchange of the neutral set boson on electrons. However, for the electron neutrinos, you have an additional contribution from so-called charge current exchange. When you have an electron neutrino interacting with an electron in the sun, exchanging W bosons. Well, to keep a long story short, what happens is that basically the electron neutrino discovers or gets something like an effective mass, as you would call it in solid state physics, which is proportional to the electron density. So what you could envisage now is the following. This is the electron density, and this is how the mass state. So the muon, assume that the muon neutrino, or the F2, is the heavier one. This doesn't have any dependence on the electron density of the sun. So it's a constant number. However, the electron neutrino mass gets an additional term, which is proportional to N over E. So here's a solar core where the electron density is very high, so then the electron neutrino mass is very large. Then it moves, if you move outward of the sun, the electron density decreases, correspondingly the electron neutrino mass somehow decreases. And then you of course meet this kind of point where both levels cross. This is anyhow, this is a resonance point. It can be shown that at this point, even if you have a small vacuum mixing angle theta, this will be amplified to maximal mixing. So the neutrinos really oscillate to something like 45 degrees. And then it depends on how you manage to go through this kind of resonance region. If you're an electron neutrino, or the current mass, the current eigenstate is only changing slowly, meaning the electron density changes little only over an oscillation length, you basically adiabatically can convert this. You can always stay in your eigenstate, and the neutrino actually leaves as the heavier muon neutrino. If this is not a case, then you have a certain jump probability that the state jumps from here to there. And this can all be calculated with, like in atomic physics, when you have two levels crossing, Landau-Zener approach of atomic level crossing with some kind of perturbation theory in quantum mechanics. It's all done in the 80s. And of course, you adjust parameters here in this range in a way that you can describe the results of the three experiments, supercomputer, chlorine, and gallium, which I have shown to you before. And then if you adjust the number of electron neutrinos chunked down here and leaves the sun as electron neutrinos, which correspond to the observed results. And as you see, the resonance of this amplification depends on the energy. So all the neutrinos basically have the resonance. The high energy neutrinos have the resonance at different points than the low energy ones. So if you try to do that, as I said, the vacuum oscillations are at 10 to the minus 11, which is around here. If you really believe that this MSW will work, you can, for example, find parameter sets which would describe the homestake chlorine. I'm sorry for the black color here. So any kind of sine squared 2c in this kind of band here, combined with the delta m square given here, would be able to describe the chlorine results by this meta oscillations. Anything within the green bands would describe the gallium experiments, and everything within the blue bands, excluding the Sperber region here, will describe everything which is observed by Kamio Kanga. So I follow here the historic way. Don't worry, this is not the up-to-date state. It's just the historic way to explain it. However, there's only one effect. So the solution should, of course, describe all three effects. And then you're basically down to this kind of three islands here. Well, you see the delta M square we're talking about now, it's not 10 to the minus 11. It's more like 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 7. So this solution is called the LMA, the large mixing angle solution, because you see sine squared theta is very close to 1. And there's a small mixing angle solution, which is where sine squared theta is between 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 3. And then there's this long oscillation wavelength solution at, again, about 1, but at 10 to the minus 7 to 10 to the minus 8. So this was the status before snow, basically. So there's only weak evidence. Of course, you could find some parameter ranges to describe that by oscillation, but it was not really a proof that the oscillations are there. And still, it was not independent of any standard solar model calculation. So the idea was to build an experiment which is independent of all the solar models. And that's the Sakurai Neutrino Observatory. Well, each big city has its own symbol. Paris has the Eiffel Tower, Toronto has the CN Tower, and Sakurai has its 24-hour smoking chimney. Of course, you know, Sakurai is a nickel town of the world. So that's our so to say, our symbol. So that's the idea of snow. It's not using normal water like superconducting, it's using heavy water. And the idea is basically, forget that one, is focusing on these two reactions. We have a reaction which is flavor sensitive. There's one so-called charge current reaction. An electron neutrino is splitting the deuteron into protons and an electron. This is sensitive to the electron neutrino. And then there's a reaction, the so-called neutral current reaction, which doesn't care about the neutrino flavor. It's just completely independent of the flavor. Any neutrino with energy more than 2.2 MeV is able to split the deuteron into its proton and neutron and leaves the detector. So by just looking at the rate of these two rates, you can tell whether the sun is responsible, whether there are oscillations or not. If this reaction is down to 30 to 50%, like Ray Davis and others have claimed, and this reaction is down to this rate as well, then you know that the real total neutrino flux from the sun is down. So the sun must be responsible. However, if you measure in the neutral current the full neutrino flux you expect from the sun, while this reaction is down by to 30%, then there's basically no way to ascribe this problem to the sun. It must be neutrino oscillation. There's no way how to explain it otherwise. So this was a kind of smoking gun. Compare this rate with this rate, which is independent of the sun. It's just the measurement of two rates in one experiment. So this is basically the current, large fraction of the current gang still working on that during the collaboration meeting. This is snow during installation. So you see this kind of acrylic, what's called acrylic vessel, or this balloon here, filled with this heavy 1,000 tons of heavy water. And the surrounding here is filled later on after these people are removed with light water. And then you see this kind of metallic support structure and this kind of blobs of so-called light detectors or photomultipliers, 10,000 of those, because each electron flying through the tank produced in this reaction is actually getting a kick, pushing them beyond the speed of light and water, and then these electrons start to emit light, which is called Cherenkov light, and that's where the photosensors are made for to detect them. So the experiment is, as I said, it's in Sudbury, so this is the CN Tower in comparison. It's at 6,800 feet, so you go down in the mine. It's an active nickel mine, not a dead mine. They have to walk another mile till you actually reach snow. But how does such a typical snow day look like? Especially in winter, obviously it starts to snow. So if you go in the morning to the mine at minus 30 degrees, for example, with a lot of snow, fine, half an hour later you find yourself at plus 40 degrees in a rather messy environment, dusty and warm and humid. And another half an hour later, you find yourself in a clean room, in a real clean room conditions. It's about 15 degrees. This is a snow control room. This is the entrance door to the detector. So this is a typical kind of snow day. So what is snow doing? The snow is running in three phases. Probably have heard about this experiment here more than I expected. So this is well, the pure D2O phase, which has a good sensitivity to the electron neutrino flux. a little bit, could also measure the total neutrino flux already. But to get an enhanced sensitivity for this total neutrino flux, this neutral current measurement, I said, people plugged in, we plugged in 2 tons of sodium chloride, just normal salt, to enhance the neutron capture rate, because as you remember, this flavor blind reaction is basically relying on neutron detection. And in the phase three, we are now in, we have a completely different method to detect neutrons by putting in proportional counters. Again, you see the cross section is even larger, and then you can even tell by event phase whether we have seen a neutron or not, while here it's basically fitting distributions and disentangling them in 2 contributions, CC and NC. So as you see here, phase three, this one, this running will finish end of the year, and this will be the end of snow data taking end of the year. So also from the first phase, from the pure D2O phase, as I told you, we did this kind of fitting. These are the snow data points. As I said, we only sensitively borrowed 8 neutrinos. This is a spectrum, and if it would be really 35% of the standard solar model, it would follow this bluish curve here. But as you see, the data overshoot and really agree pretty nicely with the solar model, which is basically given in this green range here. So as it turns out, snow actually observed the full solar neutrino fluxes. The dotted lines are the model predictions, and the bluish band is the snow numbers. This is the electron neutrino flux, and this is a possible muon or tau neutrino flux. We can't tell which one. And you see, this fits pretty nicely, and this is the best fit point. So it's not the problem as the other experiment that we have missing neutrinos, it's just the wrong ones are coming. 60 or 70% of the solar neutrinos are coming or penetrating the Earth in form of muon or tau neutrinos instead of electron neutrinos. So this is a kind of plot I showed you before, this double log plot. This were the 3 kind of islands, and after the snow phase, everything basically collapsed to this LMA solution. This meta effects in the sun is large mixing angle as the only viable solution. Well, our Japanese were a little bit of gambling here, which disadvantages. Even before the snow data were all disadvantages. If the LMA solution is correct and delta M squared 10⁻, what kind of vacuum distance or vacuum oscillation length would it mean to see it on Earth? If you have nuclear power plants, then you come up with a number of 150 to 200 kilometers to see the first minimum or possible electron antineutrino flux from reactors. And they built an experiment in Japan called Kamlan. So you have a bunch of nuclear power plants around, and this one's really nicely formed kind of circle of 180 degrees around the mine where Kamiokande was located, and Super Kamiokande still is. And those people build a detector there, called, as I said, Kamlan. And they see a clear deviation from the expected positron spectrum from a nuclear power plant, but from the antineutrino capture I showed you before to what they actually observe. And this kind of detailed fitting is really sensitive to delta M, very sensitive to delta M squared. So you see this kind of LMA island from the solar results, and you see how Kamlan basically say it must be in this range or in this range, but that's the only options. Well, in the meantime, SNOW has published their results on the salt data, which can have an enhanced sensitivity on this neutral current, the same plots you have seen before. The charge current, the neutral current ratio is indeed 34%, like other people have said. Ray Davis was completely right, and he surely deserves a Nobel Prize for being persistent that he is right on his detector. The numbers have condensed more precisely here, the same business, and this is the current state of the art, basically. SNOW fixes, or the solar data fixes theta for you, and Kamlan fixes delta M squared. So this is the latest island. This is the latest island from the solar data, and Kamlan is basically pushing, as you can see here, pushing, selecting a single delta M square value out of this. So everything condenses to this tiny island of about 8 × 10⁻⁵ delta M square, and theta 10 tangent square theta of about 0.4, which is 434 degrees roughly. But this is outstanding. I mean, this is 5 years, even 5 years ago, you would never have plotted in delta M square and sine square to theta or tangent square theta in a linear range, but only double logarithmic, but nowadays you even can do that in a linear scale. So it's really enormous, enormous progress in this field. Oh, I'm running out of time. I only want to mention the other evidences. We have the atmospheric neutrinos I mentioned before. Kamio Kande has observed that muon neutrinos producing muons in the water coming from above and below show a different rate, while the electron neutrinos don't show this effect. This you can see here. This is a Monte Carlo expectation for muons. Sorry, here's the muons. And these are the muons coming from above when the pions are produced on top of the detector in the atmosphere. And these are the muons coming from below when the muons are produced in the atmosphere, but the muon neutrinos are produced in the atmosphere, but on the other side of the Earth. So as you see, the longer they have to go, the less they are, while the electrons still look like they should be. So it seems like that the muon neutrinos which have to go 12,000 kilometers seem to be less than those which have only to go 20 kilometers going straight down to the detector instead of passing through the Earth before. So there's a deficit in muon neutrinos, and if you ascribe it again to oscillations, you come up with a delta M square of about 2.5 times 10 to the minus 3 eV square. Notice here's now the muon neutrino involved, while the other one, the solar neutrinos, are the electron neutrinos. And this has been confirmed again on Earth with an experiment called K2K. People were actually reproducing a high energy accelerator shooting protons on a target, as I said before, producing pions. Pions decay to muon and muon neutrinos, and people were looking at super Kamio Kande whether they see the full flux of muon neutrinos. And they didn't see the full flux, and they could also describe it by oscillation parameters, which are in agreement with the ones you get from the atmospheric results. But then the latest player in this game is MINOS. In the States, we shoot this, the same principle, you shoot protons on a target at Fermilab, and 730 kilometers away in the Sudan line in Minnesota. You have a huge detector, and again, you want to measure the muon neutrino flux, and these are the first results from MINOS published last week. And again, you see, they see the deficit of muon neutrinos. This is a sort of some super Kamio Kande region of the atmospheric neutrinos, and these are the first MINOS type of oscillation parameters which would describe the deficits they observe. So everybody sees some kind of a deficit here as well, and the fine part, the nice part, is that most of the parameter spaces are actually overlapping, so that's good news. And from the European point of view, they were planning the same, like Fermilab and MINOS, shooting a beam from CERN in Geneva to Panzazzo laboratory. Unfortunately, it has the same baseline, 732 kilometers, pretty much exactly the same baseline. So these people decided, well, we don't have to redo MINOS. We want to actually see whether the muon neutrino is oscillating in a tau neutrino. So they have chosen a beam which is optimized for tau neutrino production, and the detectors in Panzazzo are optimized to see a new tau interaction producing a real tau, and you can measure this tau electron in your detector. So this MINOS type of thing is a so-called disappearance experiment. You only check that muons are disappearing, but this one is focused to be an appearance event. You want to see where the muon neutrinos are going. Are they really going in tau neutrinos or not? And this one I'm aiming for, and the beam should be online in a few weeks or months. How many minutes do I have still? Another 10? Okay. And the third one we are waiting for desperately. This is a kind of oscillation evidence. The atmospheric 2. Delta F is about 10 to the minus 3. Maximal mixing 9 square cuzida is about 1. Solar neutrinos 8 times 10 to the minus 5. Involving electron neutrinos, involving muon neutrinos, and then there's a third evidence which is highly hotly debated, LSNB, which is up here. And if this is true, it would be muon neutrino to electron neutrino oscillations. And hopefully, an experiment currently performed at Fermilab will tell us in summer whether this is true or not. Because if all of them are true, then we have a real problem. For theorists, it would be probably even nicer, it would be a real challenge. Because you have mu and you E here, mu to mu something here, and you E to mu something here. However, if you have three flavors, you can only build two independent delta M squares. So this wouldn't fit. So you use this one, but this one would never, 10 to the minus 3 square plus 10 to the minus 2 square would never make it to 1 square. So then we need more neutrinos to do that. And then really things are getting completely mad, I guess. So let's talk for a second about the absolute mass measurements for the rest of the talk. As I said, the solar neutrinos, the neutrino oscillation only changes delta M square. So if you make a plot of M1 square, M2 square, and M3 square, you can see the M1 square is basically flavor composition like that. And the splitting to M2 square is driven by the sun, and the bigger splitting is driven by the atmospheric. Or it could be vice versa, we don't know. And if the masses are, the absolute masses are really high, they all could look like almost degenerated, and the splitting looks more like a fine structure and a hyperfine structure. And we don't know really the offset of the whole mass range because we have no absolute mass measurement yet. So that's the kind of idea what people want to explore. We have to figure out about the absolute mass, and that's where beta decay and double beta decay comes into the game. So what is beta decay? It's obviously, as we spoke about before, the nucleus decays emitting an electron antineutrino, or if you like, a neutron going to a proton. This is double beta decay. It's basically two neutrons decaying and two protons, two electrons, and two antineutrinos, which is fine, which is allowed. It's just a higher order process, so to say. The half-lives you have to measure is about 10 to 20 years, which is by no means a trivial task. But the exciting mode for neutrino physics is a neutrinoless double beta decay. You have a certain nucleus decaying into its order, emitting two electrons and emitting no neutrinos at all. So this is, as you can see here, this is a lepton number, total lepton number violating. So you can maybe envisage it as you have a neutron emitting a right-handed antineutrino at some point, which must be absorbed as a second neutron in the same nucleus in a magical way as a left-handed neutrino. So the first condition you have, a neutrino and an antineutrino must be the same. So it is only possible if neutrinos are their own antiparticles. If neutrinos are Dirac particles, this will never occur. And the second thing you have to do is you have to convert, you have to match the helicities, which means you have a right-handed object here, which must have a left-handed component to be absorbed at the second vertex. And the easiest way to do that is to give neutrinos a non-vanishing mass. So the second condition, these are two independent conditions. The second condition is we need a massive object. However, I should mention, especially for theorists, you can treat this as a black box. Whatever kind of new physics you want to study, you plug in here, which is total lepton number violating. Total lepton number violating by two units will do the job for you. For example, R parity SUSY, double charged Higgs bosons, lepton quarks, and whatever you might want to put in here, right-handed recurrence. And so on. So this is the point, you can also make limits on other physics. But the standard law or the standard people look at is massive Majorana neutrinos. Just a word on the beta decay searches. So what we know on the absolute masses, you look at the endpoint of a tritium beta decay, because if you know the endpoint precisely, a neutrino has a rest mass, there is an offset mu c square, which the electrons can get. So the electron energy spectrum ends up earlier, and it's tilted as well. And the current experiments have a sensitivity. They claim a limit on the electron neutrino mass of less than about 2 eV. That's the current state of the art. And people are preparing a new experiment called Petrin, which is a massive monster. So these are the current spectrometers you use for that. And this is the current site, and this is a new one. And this is really a huge vacuum vessel of 22 meters length, 10 meter diameter, pumped down to 10 to the minus 11 bar, which means you need a pumping power of about 500,000 liters per second to keep this vacuum at this level. Tritium sources, very high tritium sources, because in this endpoint range, only about 10 to the minus 15 of all the electrons anyhow will make it, because most of the spectrum is in the lower energy part. And they want to go down to 0.2 eV, so another 10th an order of magnitude improvement. And hopefully everything is working in 2 years. So this is a beta decay, probably the ultimate experiment. So from beta decay, from double beta decay point of view, I mentioned that already. You can look in the table of isotopes, all known information. You know, this is a preferred candidate which can do beta d, double beta decay. It can't do a single beta decay because the ground state of the next isotope is higher. So single beta decay is forbidden by energy conservation. But the guy who is two further up in set, and they have all the same atomic numbers, you see 76, but they have different proton and neutron numbers. So in principle, it could go from here to there. And this is the kind of triangular situation you need for double beta decay to occur. Single beta decay is forbidden, but in principle, in some kind of a two-step process or a tunneling or a virtual transition over here, or whatever you want to call it, allows for double beta decay. And if you look around in the table of isotopes and all the 3,500 or 4,000 isotopes we know in nature, you only find 35 of those guys which have a ground state which is showing this kind of relation to the neighbors. If you look in the experiments, which are really suitable because of decay rate, which means your sensitivity scales with a fifth power of the energy release, which is basically the energy difference from here to there. So the larger, the more sensitive you are actually down to about 11, which have at least 2,000 keV energy release, which makes the experimental search easier and all of the sensitivity better. So these are the typical isotopes you find in all double beta decay papers that people are looking for experimentally. From the point of view, it's a decay. So what you observe is not a neutrino mass, obviously, it's a half-life. And the funny part is, if you have the two neutrino mode, it's the same like what Wolfgang Pauli was talking about. If you plot the sum energy of the both electrons, they share these two neutrinos, which will escape, so it's a continuous one. However, for the experimentalists, much nicer is a neutrinoless mode, actually, because if you don't emit neutrinos, both electrons have to share the full Q value, and you actually have a peak, and you know precisely where to look at where this peak should occur. And if you have this kind of peak position, if you either find something, you get a half-life. If you don't find anything, you get a lower limit on the half-life. And this one is then linked to the neutrino mass. 1 over the half-life is a calculable phase-based kinematics. You can know this number. Then there's a transition, nuclear transition matrix element, which is a kind of a source of uncertainty. And then neutrino mass divided by electron mass squared. Let's skip that. So the current world leading experiment, the Heidelberg-Moskau experiment, because the isotope I showed you before is a germanium isotope, as the two slides before, germanium 76. And this is the germanium semiconductor detectors, and they are well known in nuclear physics and particle physics for decades, because you have an extraordinary good energy resolution, which is important because then you get sharp peaks and not kind of a flat distribution. So and the other important point is the isotope is already part of your crystal, which means the detector is decaying. Obviously, it's not really dangerous, as you can see, that we're talking about half 10 to 25 years. So this is the kind of thing you do. You put one of those germanium detectors, which is very clean. You put it underground in a mountain, in a tunnel like snow. You shield it again with lead. For example, this is 400-year-old lead. There was a ship which sank in the Mediterranean 400 years ago, and they brought up this ship, and it had lead in it, which is very clean from the radioactive point of view, which is a major background. And half of it went to the archaeologists to study it, and the rest was formed to bricks to make shielding. And then you have copper, very clean, and another, you imagine this is here, another 10 tons of lead around for 1 kilogram detector. So this is a kind of art game you play, and you see here the installation of 4 more detectors. You have to be very careful that you don't bring in any kind of radioactivity from your mouse, from your fingers, from your hairs, from whatever. And I can't even exclude that one of those guys as myself. And the real big advantage, besides having a lot of detectors, 11 kilograms, is that they are even isotopically enriched, which means you are not interested in germanium itself, you are only interested in one isotope of germanium. This is number 76. And it has only a natural abundance of 8%, and these detectors are isotopically enriched to 86%. The Russians use their atomic weapon centrifuges for doing that. So that's why they have the Heidelberg-Moskau collaboration. Well, in the official last paper, they didn't find any peak at this position. This is a blown-up version where it should be the peak. And they published the lower limit on the half-life of 10 to 25 years. and deduce that the neutrino mass is 0.35, less than 0.35 eV. Again, remember this is only valid if it's not, it's Majorana particle, that beta decay doesn't care. However, a subgroup of the collaboration did a reanalysis and they now claim they see a peak. This is a peak sig they could dig out of the data, and they now claim they have observed it. And if this is true, the neutrino mass would be somewhere between 0.2 and 0.6 eV. And at this point, I normally have to make a personal remark, as usual. Everybody in the world agrees, all the competitors of this experiment, that the Heidelberg Moscow data set itself is the best data set ever taken in the world of double beta decay. And I have to defend it because it's my PhD work, anyhow, to build up these detectors here. However, not everybody in the world agrees on this kind of evidence some people have finally in the last 2-3 years deduced out of those data. But that's a full story for the colloquium by itself. Well, the remaining 2-4 minutes probably I don't have. But I should say, my new approach, I'm somehow stuck with semiconductors because of their nice energy resolution, but I want to use different isotopes, cadmium zinc tellurides, which unfortunately can't be grown, built in big detectors. You only have tiny cubes, which is actually not a disadvantage if you look in more detail. And you see here you have to build some kind of baking plates out of those tiny cubes. And we are working in Clansalvo, that's where we are right now. Skip all those stuff. So this is kind of summary. You see this is really an active field, and you find various proposals on, and that's not even a complete list, and we don't know which one will really happen in the future. The point is if Splatter or this peak is wrong, and the oscillations will guide us to something like 50 milli electron volts, where we really should see something. Remember, the atmospheric delta M square is about 2 × 10⁻³. If you take the square root out of that, then you are roughly at about 50 milli electron volts. One of the neutrinos did test to have 50 milli electron volts, otherwise you can never make a delta M square of 3 × 10⁻³. And if this turns out to be true, then you have to measure half-lives in the order of 10 to the 26 to 10 to the 27 years even. And if you skip through the last slide, if you just take the radioactive decay law, assuming the best of all worlds to measure half-life in this region, you need hundreds of kilograms of the isotope to have one event per year. Imagine that. You have hundreds of kilograms and you're looking for one single decay per year. So this is the art of the field, like in solar neutrinos. So let me come to my outlook. Well, there is now a 2-fold way, not an 8-fold way, like in the Asian religion. Here, we are, of course, there are two ways to go. We have to find out what is the absolute neutrino mass, and the other one is now, obviously, to look for the precise determination of the mixing matrix element. It's not called ZKM in the electrons, it's called MNS or PMNS. And obviously, to find the ultimate goal, to find the P violation in the electron sector. So basically doing all the work the quark people have done in the last 40 years to pin down this mixing matrix elements. So this is what I already said to you. Coupling is going online in 2008. Neutrinoless double beta decay is a hot issue. Cosmology is improving quite a lot and is placing limits and bounds on the absolute neutrino masses, the sum of the absolute neutrino masses, which is in the same ballpark like the current beta decay limits of about an eV. The oscillations, I told you, MINOS has just reported their first results, so they will be more and more precise in the future. MINIBOON is the experiment which is proposed to test this LSMD evidence, which I only shortly mentioned, and we hope to have results in the summer. The CERN-Clansalvo beam will be online this year, and there are future projects which are working towards figuring out the P phases and the ultimate thing. And the accelerator base is probably what people call a neutrino factory. I didn't have time to go through that. I have to apologize for everything I haven't mentioned. I told you before that this is 50 minutes. It's completely impossible. There's a whole cosmology part, the high energy part, supernovae, low energy real-time experiments for solar neutrinos, and precision measurements of weak interaction stuff. So let me summarize. Neutrino physics, I think, made major progress, and not only myself, other people think that as well. In the last 5 to 10 years, we made major progress, and nobody has no doubt anymore that neutrinos indeed have a non-vanishing rest mass. finally, after 30 years, when Ray Davis came up with his first results, we have the solar and the solar neutrino problem is now considered to be solved. It's indeed so-called matter oscillations, which are at work. This is MSW mechanism, and Snow was a major player in solving this problem by this independence of the solar model. And actually, we are thinking about an option which is called Snow Plus. And when the heavy water is removed by end of the year, we might replace it by filling it with liquid scintillator, which has no threshold for Cherenkov light, so we could go lower in energy and still keep the option of having energy and time information. And this is currently under discussion in Snow. I tried to show you the second example, that double beta decay is gold-plated channel to really check whether neutrinos are their own antiparticles or not. But the currents oscillate. Taking the current evidences from the oscillations, if you really have to go down to 50 millielectron volts, this hydrograd peak is wrong, then beta decay probably won't make it, because as you heard, cutting stops at 0.2, we have to go to 0.05, then probably double beta decay is the only way to do that. COBRA is, as I said, my new idea. It's a new real existing experiment now, at least on a half kilogram scale, and there are a lot of other projects and going on in the future to pin down the matrix elements and so on, where this called neutrino factory is the ultimate facility for neutrinos. So there are still a lot of things to do, and giving people at Cliff a good time to think about all these funny things, and especially neutrinos have never done what you expect them to do, so there's surely room for new discoveries. Thank you.
So in all those experiments for the fractions for masses, what's the prospect of getting down to a mass which is the minimum? You know, there's a mass that you have to find at some level, say, with these oscillation experiments, if one of them is the lightest one of the masses.
Yeah.
So how long do we have to wait before the direct delta decay or type of experiments get that level?
Well, currently, there's only one of those big lists I mentioned to you, is only one really approved for a mass scale which has at least a few hundred kilograms of the isotope, which is called Corori. All the other proposals are proposals in a certain way, or they have a smaller amount running, which might bring them up to 10 to the 24 years, or 10 to the 23, 10 to the 25 in the best of all worlds. We surely have to wait another 10 to 15 years, unfortunately I'm quite sure, because it's, if you install on several hundred kilograms, and you, what the art what people always call is background free, which means that the region where your peak occurs, there's nothing, really not a single event in the whole measuring time, which is putting energy in there as well from any kind of a background reaction which you don't want, right? Otherwise, this kind of radioactive decay law must be, it's not everything you have to take into account, and your sensitivity isn't that good. And there are surely components nobody has ever thought about, which we have to worry about at that point of view. And it will be at least 10 years, 15 years. As I said, Heidelberg Moscow were 11 kilograms. Coromicino is currently running as 40 kilograms. But as I told you, for one event per year, you have to run with, let's say, 500 kilograms isotopic enriched. No background. It will take 2015, 2020, quite sure. And there's nothing funded really besides this tellurium oxide experiment.
So once you've augmented the standard model to account for the masses and the oscillations in the neutrinos, well, my question is, so once you have that, do you have enough to produce CP violation, or do you need to also make further extensions of the standard model to get the
well, as it's pretty much like in the quarks, if you're lucky, I have the slide somewhere. I mean, the first thing we have to solve for the CP violation issue is the fact that, like in the quark sector, any CP phase is always coming in product with a sign theta 1 3. So the first thing we have to know, is how big is theta 1 3. We currently only have a limit that you know theta 1 3, the third mixing angle, which is currently basically unknown, is less than 12 degrees. And it is getting smaller, 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 smaller. And we have a fair chance that even in the neutrino factory will never observe CP violation because the effect becomes too tiny. But the CP phase itself is the E to the delta. We have no clue at all. It could be anything. A nice feature when you believe in Majorana neutrinos, just find this slide again. If you believe in Majorana neutrinos, there's maybe an advantage because, just 1 second, I will find it, sure. Yeah. If you believe in Majorana neutrinos, so this is this famous matrix. This is a CKM type of thing, or MNS. This is always a product sign, theta 1 3 times E, which comes in. However, if your neutrinos are Majorana particles, the freedom to rotate phases away in the theory because of the connection that antiparticle and neutrinos are linked now together by charge conjugation. You don't have this freedom anymore. At the end of the day, you turn up with two additional possible CP violating phases. And people thinking about leptogenesis to explain barrier symmetry in the universe, they normally use heavy Majorana neutrinos and CP violating decays of those chaps to do the lepton number violation, which at the electroweak phase transition is partly converted into barrier symmetry. And people hope if you can link the low mass sector like Majorana neutrinos somehow with the SETI scales, that you may get a feeling from double eta decay for that. So here are two possible new sources of CP violating phases. What this phase actually is, nobody knows. And as you can see, because they are on the diagonal, if you do the oscillation parameters U, dagger U, these ones will vanish. So this path phases don't pop up in oscillation experiment. They only show up in double eta decay. And this is, of course, makes the interpretation what you actually measure a little bit more complex, because you have CP phases here and you have some could have destructive interference among the terms coming in here. So it's not, if you compare double beta decay numbers with speed decay numbers, you have to be very careful. They are actually more complementary than competitive. But we don't know. The first thing what people are aiming for now is getting a better feeling how large this angle theta 1 3 is. If this is too small, you probably won't observe CP violation in the lepton sector.
Are there any other experiments on double beta decay with those different isotopes that you listed? Are there any proposals?
I have a list. I can shortly flash you the list.
Yeah.
So there is this group in Japan which talks about calcium 48. I know they have. They have about 100 kilograms indeed of these detectors,
really?
In their hands. Yeah.
But that the usual calcium is 40.
That's the point. I mean, nature is not really supportive.
So how do they get?
No, nature is not supportive.
Yeah.
They have basically no natural abundance. They have the best of all Q values, but they have hardly any isotopes. That's why they have 100. They have no enrichment. They use naturally. That's why if you condense it to the isotope of interest, the 180 kilograms converge down to a few grams, right? So the other ones, and let me flash through. So this is, they have 180 kilograms. I've seen the crystals in December. We have half a kilogram of cadmium telluride semiconductors running. ECBA has nothing. NEMO has 10 kilograms running. Cameo is dead. It's candles. I shouldn't be. Carbon is a dead one. This one, they have 180 kilograms. Sorry. Gori has 40 kilograms running. EXO has 200 liters of xenon in their hands, but nothing running yet. This is dead. This is dead. Gerda has the current world combined Heidelberg Moscow detectors and from another experiment. So they have 17 kilograms of detectors, but not yet running. This is not running. This is some few kilograms running here. Here's nothing running. This is not running, and this is not running, because this is the current state, basically, of the
art. So there's only one.
So currently, there are only two large scale experiments. Coricino, a small version of 40 kilograms here, NEMO 3 with 10 kilograms of isotopes, and the third largest one is already my one with 0.5 kilograms. That's currently everything is running well. Hopefully, by end of the year, Gerda will be running with the germanium detectors of the level of 17 kilograms by using the old Heidelberg Moscow detectors and the competitor experiment iChex in former times. So this would be your, but in anyhow, they only will make it again to check this club door peak of, I showed you. So for the real large table, what Cliff was asking, oh, we have to wait much longer still. As I said, these are proposals, or we don't know, they will be probably shootout by funding agencies one by one. And at the end, there will be two or three experiments if we are lucky.
Any other questions?